Ruth's story, well, Naomi's story is kind of how we've been looking at it. And I kind of imagine it this way, because we need to finish today. I kind of imagine myself asking a question of Naomi. If Naomi was here, standing right there, and I could say, Naomi, as you looked back at all the years of your life, what are the things you learned about God? What are the things you learned about walking with God, about who he is and what a life of faith looks like? And I think, and I can make a Bible case, that there are at least six. Some we've already looked at, so don't worry. It's not like 6 points of the sermon, because that we wouldn't make it. But as you kind of think through the whole story and all the setting and all the scenes and all the hardships and the challenges and the joys and all those kind of different things, I think there's at least six. There's probably more, but number one, and I've already mentioned it, is that how things appear and how things feel is not how they necessarily are. And I'm so glad for that, because there will be seasons where how you feel about life and the things you are pretty convinced you see can be hard. It could just look like there is no other side to that issue or obstacle. And you think of Naomi's story. If it's unfamiliar, the quick version goes like this, starting in chapter one of Ruth. And Ruth has a pretty simple plot line. There's essentially two big problems and two big solutions. So problem, solution is kind of how the story goes in four chapters. Naomi leaves Bethlehem because there's a famine. She leaves with her husband and two sons. They go to Moab, which is, we haven't talked much about this. Moab is not a good place to go. If you go all the way back into Genesis and you see the origins of the Moabite people, it is a tricky story. It probably doesn't show up in too many Sunday school lessons. Lot, who is Abraham's nephew, if you remember the story of Abraham who leaves Ur and goes to the land God's going to show him, he takes his nephew along. Lot eventually, quite near the end of the story, impregnates one of his daughters. And the son is named Moab, and he is the father of the Moabite people. And of course, origins like that of the story of incest and just so much of scripture, I hope you know, is descriptive, not prescriptive. You know the difference? Sometimes people get confused. It's like, well, I read it in scripture. Does that mean that's how it's supposed to be? It's like, no, it's describing what happened, not saying what you ought to do. And this is certainly one of those cases. Goes kind of without saying, but that's the story of the Moabite people. So it's a very, very broken beginning point. And from that point on, the nation of Israel, the Jewish people and the Moabite people were arch enemies. And so the idea that Naomi and her husband and boys would leave Israel and go to Moab right off the get-go is a very strange twist to the story, but they leave because there's a famine. And so there's all this hardship baked into the plot line. They get to Moab. The boys get married to Moabite women, which probably if you're a Jewish mom, that's not your dream. And then Naomi's husband dies. And then her two boys die. And Naomi's left with two Moabite daughter-in-laws. And then she gets word that the famine in Bethlehem is over. And so she decides to go back. And she's on the road with the daughters when she says to them, you should just go home. Don't come with me. There's nothing for you. God brought me to Moab. I was full when I got to Moab, but God has taken everything. And I'm empty and bitter, and there's nothing. Why don't you just go back to your people and to your gods? I'll go back to Bethlehem, empty and bitter, and that'll just be the parting of the ways, end of story. Maybe there'll be some sort of hope for you back in Moab. The one daughter-in-law goes back. Ruth, of course, if you know the story, because her character is pretty spectacular, she says, no. Nope. Where you go, I will go. Your God will be my God. And it's actually right in that little speech that Ruth delivers that we see the first amazing glimpse of Ruth's faith, because she actually just doesn't talk about God as a generic deity, which would have been kind of the more common way of speaking of God. There's all these gods and the different nations had different gods. Ruth actually hones in and uses the personal covenant name of God, which sometimes I don't think we quite, maybe you all get this. Sometimes I forget how profoundly significant the use of that name is. I will illustrate it imperfectly, but in a way that I think will get the point. If next week, Riley and Quintana are here, they will be. They're here, and you go up to Riley and call him your husband. Or Quintana and call her your wife. You are not going to get a very good reception. Rightfully so. They're probably going to look at you really weird and tell you to stop doing that. Right? Because you are not in a relationship. That is a title to describe a person of covenant. Right? Husband and wife. Only they get to call each other that term. In a similar way, the use of the name Yahweh, or in your Bible, when it's the capital L-O-R-D, Lord, capital L-O-R-D, that signifies the use of that personal name of God coming from the early part of Exodus. That speaks of the fact that you have a relationship with God that is a covenant relationship. People outside that covenant don't speak of God in that way. They would never use that term, just like you wouldn't call, you know, if you're a man, you wouldn't call someone else's wife. You would never call her wife, right? Is that, I don't know. It makes complete sense in my mind. I don't know. I'm getting some funny looks. I'll just pretend you all understood what I talked about, but I hope the point is somewhat clear that when Ruth calls God Yahweh, she's describing a pretty profound relationship. She's saying, I know him and he knows me. And your God will be my God. And where you go, I will go. And where you die, I will die, because I'm not going to leave you or God. And so they go back to Bethlehem. But by chapter 2, we realize, or Naomi finally will realize, that how things appear and how things feel is not necessarily how they are, because she thinks she is empty and bitter. Look at the theology of chapter 2, verse 20. Naomi becomes one of the most brilliant theologians in one simple verse, where she will say essentially this: the Lord never forsook his love towards me. Right? She looks back at all that. She's like, I was wrong. I thought I was empty. I thought my life was bitter. Now I've come to realize how I thought I saw things and how I felt about things was not accurate. Through all of that, while I couldn't see it and didn't feel it, the Lord had not abandoned me. The Lord had not forsaken me. And she uses a wonderful Bible word that there is no English equivalent to. But you often translate it loving kindness or loyalty or faithful compassion or all these kind of words. It's like a massive word that just speaks to the fact that when God makes a commitment to his people, he is for them. He is committed to it. He's going to be kind to them. He's going to love them. And there will be no end. He's all in. And Naomi goes, he always was all in. I just didn't see it. I didn't feel it. And I think if Naomi was here, the first thing she would want you to know is the thing I learned through my life. God never left me. There's not a moment. I might have felt forsaken, but I was not forsaken. The second thing I think she would want us to know, again, from chapter 2, we looked at this last week or a couple weeks ago. Nothing just happens. We might speak of that. There's a little expression. You probably heard of it, maybe said it. Dumb luck, right? It's a funny little phrase. It kind of basically says there are these random things happening in life that have no intelligence behind them, right? It's dumb and it's luck. Naomi would come and say, there was maybe a moment where it felt like that, but I came to know that there was a wise, kind, compassionate God who was ordering all things, even when I couldn't see them and couldn't understand them, even when the series and sequence of events was like mysterious and hard to put together, he never stopped being there directing all things. Nothing happens by dumb luck or chance. The third thing I think she would want us to know, coming out of, again, chapter 2 and a little bit of chapter 3, is that the people who receive God in that way, the people who are in that covenant relationship with God, don't enter into it because they have a great resume and an amazing series of qualifications. This was the, for those who are hockey fans, this was NHL draft week. Just give me a slight nod, those of you who know about this. There are a few of us. I am not, I don't watch, I have TV. I don't have any sort of package to watch things. So I don't watch hockey, but I follow hockey. Someone after first service, like, makes no sense. But I do, like, so I can read online. I was watching the draft online. Okay, just a slight aside. I was really struggling with pick number three. Some of you know what that means. I am still unsure, right? Pick 24, I am totally on board with. 33, anyway. Okay. In a draft, you are picking the best players. That's the goal, right? And so they run them through all these drills and combines, and they meet with them, and they look at their records. Like, we want the best player available. That's what I keep telling the Canucks, and they keep not doing it. But that's the point of a draft, right? Best player available. There's something about that mentality that is easy to bring into our understanding of God. That somehow God is kind of like running a draft, and he just wants the best and the brightest. And we get in if we have enough skill, enough, we've done enough for God, we've proved ourselves enough for God. And there's hints at certain points in the story that some characters almost might think that way or assume that's how it worked. And then in chapter 2, Ruth comes along, and I'm so glad for this moment, where Boaz answers her question. We looked at this again a couple weeks ago, where she asks in verse 10, I think it is, why have I found favor in your eyes? That's Ruth asking Boaz. And Boaz answers it in verse 11 and 12 when he says, essentially, here's the paraphrase, I have heard and seen how you loved and served Naomi. You never complained. You never said, look, you brought me to this crummy place and we're poor. You should go out and get me food. Like, what's going on here? No, she just went out, took initiative, worked hard, served her mother-in-law. No trace of complaints or bitterness. In fact, the question on her lips is not, why is my life so crummy? I deserve better. The question is, why have I found favor? You hear just the very unique attitude. It's like, my life is so good. Why is it as good as it is? That's an amazing question. That's the question Boaz is answering. He's like, well, I saw how you cared for Naomi. I know the story. And not only that, but I saw that you threw yourself under the care and protection of God. That's that little statement of under his wings or under his skirt. Becomes a lyric for one of David's songs in Psalm 57. And Boaz says, and here's what I think the logic of his answer to her is. And Ruth, because of what I have heard and seen and understand of who you are and how you have approached God and how you've lived that in a relationship to Naomi, God has inserted me into your story. You see, it's not just about me providing for you and me loving you. I am just a vessel through which God is working to extend his love and provision to you. That's his answer to her. And did you hear the basis of the relationship? It's not like, Ruth, you came and you have a stunning resume. You are awesome. Look at all the great things you've done. It's like, no. The one thing you did was humbled yourself and threw yourself under the mercy of God. That's the way into a relationship with God. Always has been, always will be. When we come and confess not our greatness, but our sin, and trust God for his mercy. That's the third thing I think Naomi would want us to see. And that's kind of where chapter 2 got us. So let's read in chapter 3. By the way, we've now worked through the first problem. The first problem is there is no food. Boaz provided food. Second problem is kind of like, but what happens next? Barley season's ended. Now what? And now is there any future for Ruth and Naomi? Or like, how does this story kind of work itself out next? And that's what chapter 3 and 4 pick up. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young woman you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now she's going to go on. We'll look at the plot in here in a second, but just don't miss the fourth thing Naomi would tell us. I think Naomi would tell us this, that there is an amazing, beautiful connection between faith, hope, and love. This is the first time in the story where Naomi looks beyond herself. You notice that? Up to now, Ruth has been looking beyond herself. Ruth's been like, how do I care for my mother-in-law? Naomi is just kind of like stewing in her emptiness and bitterness. I am empty, I have nothing, and there is no hope and no future. But nothing actually has changed. Boaz was there before, Boaz is there now. The crops were there before, the crops are there now. Like, There actually is no new piece of information that's come into it. All it is that she had not seen and not understood that God was at work, and now she is starting to clue into that fact. But notice how it works itself out, right? She starts with a belief that God is actually there, and he loves her, and his loving kindness had never forsaken her. That's the belief of chapter 2, verse 20. It fuels hope. Now there is something to look forward to. Ruth, we need to think about your future. That's what's happening in chapter 3, which leads to that third thing, which is a loving service of others. Now, if you keep those three concepts in mind and read virtually any page of Paul's epistles, you will see that those three ideas are just always there on the tip of Paul's tongue. Whether he would say it point blank in a place like 1 Corinthians 13, now these three remain: faith, hope, love. You've just got to ask yourself, Paul, why do you keep connecting those dots the way you do? He'll tell you in places like Galatians chapter 5, where he talks about how we come to faith in Christ, not through our efforts, not through our obedience to the law, but just through trust in what Jesus has done for us, right? That's the faith part that fuels this hope of what's to come. And then he will start talking about the fact that chapter 5, verse 6, and maybe verse 13, of now, this is what remains: faith working itself out through love. Isn't that interesting? It's like, if I believe in God, of who he claims to be, and it gives me hope for the future, how can I help but serve and love other people? It's just all through the New Testament. 1 Peter 5 is one of the chapters I loved. That's the one where it talks about, you know, humbling yourselves under the mighty hand of God. But if you think of the logic of the whole chapter, it's just those three pieces. That we will serve one another, Peter says. Why would we serve one another? Well, because we have hope, right? We're filled with hope of the future. We don't look and go, there's nothing ahead. No, he actually talks about this glorious hope in chapter 5. And then he comes along and he says, like, resist the devil and strengthen yourself in faith. There it is, three pieces: faith that fuels hope, that fuels service. And you look at Naomi's story, what happens? The faith light bulb goes on, the hope light bulb goes on, and what's the very next thing? Ruth, we've got to find a way to get some good future for you. I said in the early service, I think because we want to encourage one another in these things, that I would just continually encourage you and instruct you. When you leave this room, go out into the foyer. Our mission ought to be, how do I go out into that room or a coffee room or wherever it is in our lives and encourage and bless someone that God brings into my path? Like, if we believe in God and know who he is and understand the hope we have, the next step is I need to figure out how to love and serve people around me that God's put in my path. And I think that's one of the things Naomi would say I realized along the way. Okay, back to this really strange scene, because now we understand what Naomi's doing. She's wanting to secure a future for Ruth. We've got to move real quick. So here's the plan. You'll see it starting in verse 2. Is not Boaz a relative with whom the... I already messed that part up two or three times. See, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, anoint yourself, put on your cloak, go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Go, uncover his feet, lie down, he'll tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. Now, this sounds like a horrible plan on many levels. This actually sounds like, Naomi, are you sure you know what you're doing? Like, you're setting up a situation that just sounds like there's going to just be a whole bunch of compromised conviction about to happen. You see in the next verse, Ruth went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was merry. He went and lied down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly and covered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled, because you would be if someone was sleeping at the end of your bed up against your feet at night and you didn't know they were there. And he said... He turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet, and he said, who are you? Remember, it's pitch black, no artificial lighting at all. And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Now notice what she says next, because Naomi does not tell her to say this. Naomi just gave her the plan. You go lie at his feet. When he wakes up, he'll tell you what to do. And you're all like, really? Like, this just feels like the Hollywood version of this right here is a really sad story, but these are two people who have actually put God first, and you're going to see what righteousness looks like in this pretty cool situation. I am Ruth, your servant. Notice what she says. Spread your wings. That's that same statement from back in chapter 2. Remember when Boaz gave her the answer, why have I found favor? This is what he says to her at that point. She's coming essentially saying, look, Boaz, I've understood what you're getting at. I've understood that what you're saying is that the love of God is being extended to me through you. I put the pieces together. And so now I'm gonna come to you and I'm gonna say essentially, I would like you to be my husband. Very strange, because the ancient world, even in our world, it's probably not as common, but in the ancient world in particular, this is not a common scenario that a young woman would initiate like this. But she comes, she initiates this relationship, she invites him to be her redeemer. And he said, verse 10, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. I still don't quite know what to make of that, because that just seems like a very unromantic title. But anyway, you made this last kindness greater than the first in that you've not gone after younger men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it's true that I am a redeemer. And you're like, yes, this is an awesome story. They come together. It's the middle of the night. They don't compromise their convictions. She invites him to be a husband, kind of kinsman redeemer. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. He agrees, like they are, this is Hallmark. They're gonna live perfectly, happily ever after. But do you know the story? He's not quite done yet. We actually ended halfway through what he says to her. It's true that I am a redeemer. Yet, like, oh, Boaz, really? Yet there's a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives. There's Boaz theology. You want theology of what a man believes about God? Like, I know God lives. You want to know why Boaz conducts himself the way he does in that threshing floor? It's because God lives and is right there with him. And that is not a threatening thing. That is a beautiful promise thing. And God lives and he's with you. If he's not willing to redeem you, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning. Notice it doesn't say she slept, because I bet you there was no way she could possibly sleep that night with all the thoughts going through. It's like, hold on a second. I thought we had this perfect plan. I thought I was going to come. I was going to invite him to be my redeemer. I know him. I know he's a worthy man. I know he can provide for me. Naomi and I had this conversation. God seemed so in it. And there's another man, and I don't even know who he is. And tomorrow I could end up married to a man that I don't even necessarily know. And I've initiated this thing, and this plan is potentially going in the ditch. Like, I don't know what she thought all night long. But again, back to point number one, how things appear and how things feel are not necessarily how they are. But I bet you she didn't sleep much that night. The next day, got to move quick because we're going to run out of time here real fast. Boaz got up, chapter 4, went to the gate, sat down. There's a business sort of order of things in the ancient world. You bring the elders of the town together at the gate. That's how you conduct business. And so whenever you see gates showing up in the Old Testament, it's a very important moment. It's sort of describing an official transaction of some sort of business arrangement. So Boaz shows up. He invites all the elders of the town. They come to the gate and he says, look, verse 3, Naomi, who's come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here, in the presence of the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there's no other beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. So in other words, there's this fellow who is the closer relative. So there comes Boaz and says, look, there's a parcel of land that needs to be bought back. You can go read Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 25 if you want to see the background of how this worked. Essentially, to make sure families didn't lose their farmland. It was very important in their heritage and culture to keep that land and to keep family names continuing on for the sake of that land. So Boaz goes, announces it. Hey, if you want to do this, there's land, it can be repurchased and you can have it. And the guy says, right at the tail end of verse 4, I will redeem it. And then Boaz says, oh, by the way, the day you buy the land from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead. Just because you're going to do the right thing doesn't mean you have to accentuate the features of the right thing. He didn't say, hey, by the way, when you get the field, you are going to get to marry the most amazing young woman who has humility, who is diligent, who has a unique care about her, who loves the Lord. Like, notice he leaves all that out. He's like, she's a Moabite. Can't fault Boaz too much at that. And so the other guy's, I can't redeem it. for the sake of my family, I can't do that. Boaz jumps right in. And that's kind of what the rest of the middle part of that chapter is about, where Boaz says, I will do it right here, right now. I will take the land. I will take Ruth, the Moabite, as my wife. And then in verse 9, all the elders of the town chime in. And this is the next thing I think that Naomi would want us to know. That when they chime in, I'll read it. We're going to really run out of time. I only brought one page up with me too. I was going to do so well. Just listen to what they say. Verse 11. All the people were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." That's not a bad blessing. That's a good starting point. Remember, Ruth's been married for 10 years and has had no kids. In the ancient world, they always thought if a woman was not able to have children, it was the woman's fault. It's just how it worked in the ancient world. There's no idea of genetics and how those things work, right? So Ruth had been unable to have children for 10 years. So presumably everyone thought Ruth won't be able to have children. And so the blessing kind of makes sense. May Ruth be like Rachel and Leah, because if you go back and read the story of Rachel and Leah, when they marry Jacob, there's this problem. Neither of them, they have problems conceiving, and God actually has to miraculously intervene and allow them to have kids. And then they have all sorts of kids. It goes back and forth quite a while, right? If you know that story. So that blessing makes complete sense. Like, okay, fair enough. That's not a bad blessing. It's the next one that is very strange. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Anyone get the reference? You can go read the story in Genesis chapter 38. I guarantee you, if you go to a bridal shower and say, "May your house be like the house of Judah and Perez and Tamar," and someone goes and reads Genesis 38, they are going to have some words for you after. Here's how the quick version of the story goes. Judah marries a Canaanite woman. They have two boys. Judah's wife dies. His first son marries a gal by the name of Tamar. His first son is Er. He dies. The second son marries Tamar. He dies. You start to see why there's kind of maybe why the elders at the gate start thinking of the plot line, because now at this point in the story, what do you have left in a family? You got Judah and one surviving daughter-in-law. Isn't that interesting? And you've got Naomi, and what do you have? One surviving daughter-in-law. And you've had a death of a spouse and a death of two sons. It's actually like very much a parallel story going on here in this whole scene. The part of Genesis 38 where it gets really messy and ugly is that Judah then wants to go and sleep with a prostitute. Tamar dresses up like a prostitute, fools him into sleeping with her, and they have a child together, a child of incest. That's the part where it's a little bit of a weird blessing. It's like, Boaz, may your family be like the family of Perez and Judah and Tamar. It's like, really? Is that? But there's another thing going on if you think through the logic of what they're saying and who they're saying it to. Boaz is about to marry a Moabite woman, who I already told you at the start, they were the offspring of an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. Hated by the Jewish people, despised by the Jewish people. And the elders of the gate, and this is the part I love, and this is the part I think Naomi would want you to know and understand. They stand at the gate and they say, if anyone is thinking at this moment, you have to kind of read that in. If anyone is thinking that Boaz is doing the wrong thing by marrying a Moabite woman, what's a wealthy Jewish man doing marrying a Moabite woman, a widow? Just don't forget our own story. Don't forget where we came from. We are the offspring of Judah. The man who married a Canaanite woman, who didn't fulfill his duty as a father and ended up with a daughter-in-law that he ended up impregnating and having a child out of. Those are our roots. And if you want to criticize this guy for his roots, like, man, follow your own family tree. Two things that I think Naomi would want us to see coming out of that. Number one, oh man, just be so careful to extend grace to other people. Be real, real careful with where you go in condemning or judging someone else by their story. But the second part is this. No one gets left out. Anyone can come to God. Anyone can throw themselves under his wings. Anyone can receive his protection and provision and his faithfulness. Anyone can receive the hope that he gives, because God's character is so good. That's the point of what is going on at the end of this story. And Naomi ends up being basically called the mother of a child. And that would, I guess, be the last and certainly not least part of the whole thing. What is the sixth thing that Naomi would want us to know? God's purposes are glorious beyond anything you will ever imagine. You might look and go, just if these couple things happen, that would be great. Let me tell you, God's purposes for you, his plans for you, are far better than anything you could ever hope for, anything you could ever dream, anything you could ever imagine. There it is. We'll close the book. Next week, we'll have a look at some prayers of scripture.